dimensions.
Now, cast your mind back to Easter time, and I don't mean chocolate and bunnies. I mean when BBC 7 set off on a bold experiment in storytelling. It's just finished. Now is your chance to hear the resulting tale in full. Here's Jim Lee.
It seems like an age since we persuaded the writer Robert Sherman to come up with the first part of the story and then let go. He had just 200 words to set the ball rolling, as did those who entered our weekly competition to write the next instalment. And what an imaginative lot you are. We had well over 800 entries to the competition with a bewildering variety of ideas of how the story should continue each week. Well, sadly, we could only pick one episode each week. It would have just got too confusing. So the story grew through the spring and the summer until we invited Robert back to write the final episode. Well, Robert's here with me in the studio to talk about how it's all gone.
Hello there, Jim.
Hello. We'll be talking some more in about 20 minutes'
all right.
time. First, we're going to get a chance to hear the whole tale.
Excellent.
Picture this. The Whole Picture. By Robert Sherman and BBC 7's listeners. It's a digital camera, Gary said helpfully, as Dina stared down at her birthday present. So I see... Dina pointed out, rather gently she thought, that she'd been angling for a holiday in Paris. Something romantic. She'd rather hoped she'd be unwrapping a Eurostar ticket, quite frankly. Gary shrugged. You take photos in Paris, don't you? But after buying the camera, he couldn't afford the holiday as well. Look, it's got telescopic zoom. That evening she gave in and installed it on her computer.
Welcome, Dina,
flashed the screen in colourful writing. And in spite of herself, she was impressed.
Click here for your photos.
Of course she knew the gallery would be empty, but she clicked anyway. And blinked. There it was. A picture of herself and Gary, smiling and waving. Over her shoulder she could see the Eiffel Tower. Dazedly she scrolled through the album. Notre Dame, Montmartre, Gary joking around with a baguette. Happy pictures. Impossible pictures of a holiday they hadn't taken. And then Dina froze. Gary filled the screen again, but no longer clowning. Instead, blood trickling from his mouth, eyes staring out at her vacantly. It was a picture of his death. Numbly, her eyes shifted between the image on screen and the camera in her hand. Not knowing what to look for, what might be significant. It was like a thousand other cameras. Absent-mindedly, she took a couple of shots and loaded them into her computer, which greeted her again.
Welcome back, Dina,
it flashed. Her room was reassuringly as she expected, the usual clutter of her life filling the screen, her notice board a kaleidoscope of the things to do that she never quite got round to. But where she'd zoomed in on the park up the road, the image made her gasp. The park she could see from her window was a bit unkempt, a bit of down-at-heel gentility in an area that constantly aspired and regularly failed to be upwardly mobile. But this park, in the image on her screen, was a thing of wonder. Incredibly tidy flower beds, huge trees with branches spreading over picnic benches, a swirling track on which a group of garish inline skaters were racing. So many times as she waited for the bus, she had thought of ways to improve the park, but had never imagined this. Dina realized that the camera's amazing pictures meant something important. But what? The urge to take more shots was overwhelming. She felt exhilarated. Her finger hovered over the on button, but the phone stopped her. It was Gary. He'd won some tickets for a concert and wanted to take her. It would be great to see her favourite band playing at Earl's Court, and she hadn't been out in ages. The journey into Waterloo was full of photo opportunities, which she resisted. But Gary wanted to play with her new toy. You do look beautiful, Dee, in this light. His attempt at being charming didn't impress. Then alarmed, she found herself looking down a telescoping lens. Gary's finger on the shutter release. No! She screamed, disturbing the other passengers. But it was too late. Gary sniggered. You're pouting like a trout, he said, looking at the screen. Dina flinched, then giggled with relief. It was the silliest expression. On the platform, Dina pointed out the direction to the underground. But Gary held up their passports. Actually, Dee, the concert's in Paris. It was a surprise. We've got the weekend. No! Gary, you can't go to Paris. You died there. Gary stared at her open-mouthed. Nice try, Dee, but practical jokes have never been your strong point. Wait a minute, she said to him, almost grabbing the camera from him. What is it now? He replied irritably. Can I have my camera back now? She snapped. Didn't he realize she was trying to protect him? Of course not, but he handed it back, eyeing her strangely. Some romantic weekend this was turning out to be. She searched the camera's memory for the fatal pictures. Nothing. Perhaps the transfer onto her computer had automatically wiped them from the camera's memory. Perhaps it had all been her imagination. If only she could remember more details about the one that showed Gary's death, she could ensure they avoided certain arrondissements. Besides, she remembered, practical jokes were his department. Maybe he'd staged the photos somehow, with fake Parisian backgrounds and tomato ketchup. The camera's prophecy of doom seemed less real to her now. On the Eurostar, she fidgeted with her engagement ring and searched the camera's memory again. There was a new picture. A hand pushing Gary from the top of the Eiffel Tower. A hand with that very engagement ring. As the train eased into the station, Dina stayed in her seat. Desperate for the image to be wiped from both memories. It couldn't mean anything. She loved Gary. They'd managed to work things out after the affair with Susan. Gary grabbed their bag and held out his hand for Dina as they left the train and joined the crowd, unaware they were being watched. Susan had waited a long time for this. She hadn't been able to forgive quite so easily. As Dina and Gary climbed into a taxi, Susan cautiously followed. She knew where they were going. The taxi arrived at the Eiffel Tower, and Dina glanced nervously around. She could see Gary buying the tickets and crossing back through the long, dark shadows. The lift noisily reached the top, allowing Dina to see forever. The wind in her face allowed her to imagine it was just a dream. She could see Gary laughing, already deep in conversation with someone. And at that point she knew. The person Gary was laughing with was Susan. Of course he didn't know that. Why would he? He'd never met Susan. He never knew about the affair. Dina wanted to storm over and stop Susan talking to Gary. She wanted to run away, the indecision humming in her head. Dina did nothing. Then Gary looked over and grinned, his usual grin that made her feel a wave of love for him. Susan mustn't have told him anything, not yet. Gary beckoned Dina over. Dina, this is Anne from work. She told me about the draw for the tickets. Who'd believe we'd both be so lucky? What Dina could believe had undergone drastic revisions lately. Frantically, she hoped Susan might have a double. Nice to meet you, mumbled Dina. No, Anne was Susan. Dina knew it as soon as their hands touched. The scent, the electricity were the same. Susan betrayed no flicker of recognition. Her ability to play her cards so close to her chest had frustrated Dina before. Take a photo of us. No! Dina almost shouted, cutting Gary off. Could Susan be responsible for the camera? It was impossible. But so were the photos Dina had seen. Dina inhaled deeply and handed the camera over, mumbling an apology. As Susan lifted the camera to frame the shot, something gleamed. Her ring was identical to Dina's. Just then, the wind changed direction, blowing Dina's hair across her face and into her eyes, her reflexes making her blink, her fear keeping them shut. In her darkness, she heard a maelstrom of languages, the admonishing tones of a German father, the high-pitched giggling of Japanese schoolgirls. She was dizzy, losing control, thought after crazy thought pounding through her paranoid mind. Buffeted by cold wind, supported by cold steel, and faced with the impending death of her fiancé, Dina needed to think. What had happened over the last few days? Yes, the photographs were a bewildering phenomenon, but the images themselves proved nothing. Was the future preordained? Did the camera lie? The images only presented possible memories. Memories that she could choose to have. That was it. The light bulb moment. She was still in control of their destiny. She had to get Gary away from Susan without arousing his suspicions. Dina ran her fingers through her hair, lifting it from her eyes. Vision restored, she pulled Gary closer to her and planted a kiss on his cheek. I love you, Dina whispered as Susan pressed the shutter release. I want you. Take me to the hotel. Now. Gary grinned his assent. It didn't look like he needed much persuading. Susan handed back the camera with a strange smile. I hope it's okay, she said. It seems to have flipped back to some old Halloween pictures. I never was much caught with cameras, I'm afraid. Dina shuddered, remembering the wall of photos she discovered at Susan's flat. Hundreds and hundreds of Dinas staring down at her. All traces of Gary carefully airbrushed out.
Let me see, said Gary. It's brand new. We didn't even have it at Halloween.
Perhaps someone returned it and the shop didn't wipe the memory clean before they resold it, suggested Susan. Gary pulled the last photo up onto the screen and his face drained of colour.
What kind of sick...
He passed the camera to Dina. A pristine marble headstone filled the screen. Gary Robert Keaton, it read. And a date. Tomorrow's date.
How are you doing this?
Dina asked Susan, struggling to keep her voice steady.
Why can't you just leave us alone?
Don't start on Anne, said Gary.
It's got nothing to do with her.
Whatever twisted game this is you're playing, Dina, it stops now. Dina touched the scratch running down her cheek as she looked at her reflection in the window. The carriage lurched into another station, her window drawn parallel with a glass display of haute couture shoes. Further down the platform, a man urinated against the wall. Chic and sordid, that was Paris. People entered and left. The doors swished shut and the carriage accelerated out of the metro station. Dina turned round. Gary was still in a huff and didn't meet her gaze. He was still tinkering with that damned camera. Dina thought back to the catfight on the Eiffel Tower. She had had enough of Susan and flipped, hair pulling, screaming and scratching. Gendarmes separating me. The shame of being banished from the tower. At least Susan had made herself scarce.
Dee, what's this? Said Gary.
Dina saw that Gary had taken the cracked casing off the camera. There was a small black rectangle in his palm.
The memory stick?
No, it was slotted underneath the memory stick.
Feel it.
Gary dropped it into her palm. It was extremely cold and pulsed. She turned it over. Dina could just make out the tiny writing. Turing Corporation.
Who on earth are Turing Corporation, Dee? They don't make cameras, do they?
I'm not sure. The only Turing I know of died in the 1950s. Alan Turing was a mathematician, the brains behind today's computer technology. Nothing to do with cameras, exactly.
Charmed by her knowledge, he had to smile.
Where did you buy the camera, Gary?
As he looked away, she assumed it was from a bloke in the pub.
Actually, Dee, this will sound ridiculous. It was delivered to me, but I never ordered it. Well, I don't think I did. I planned to buy one, so when it came, I figured I must have ordered it online after a few beers and forgot.
As Gary spoke, the train came to a screeching halt. All the lights went out, apart from the small black rectangle that Gary still held in his hand. Through his fingers could be seen an orange glow. Strangely, no one on the train panicked. They all just sat and waited.
Gary, put that thing down.
He opened his hand, but the rectangle had gone. Just the subdued orange glow could be seen from beneath his skin.
I can't, Dee, said Gary. The Hospital Robert Debray thought her story a mistranslation, even when she spoke directly in French. At least now they were looking at Gary's hand and had gently suggested she lead them to it. Dina went to the waiting area for a coffee and then picked up a payphone, dialing angrily. She could just see Gary, looking so helpless, and blew him a kiss.
Turing Corporation,
came a male voice.
Complaints, Dina spat. Service, somebody!
The voice chuckled.
Hello, Dina.
Then he chuckled again.
Oh, we know the same way you knew this number. Don't sweat it. Now, where are you?
Dina glanced around, half expecting to see the speaker watching her.
Oh, damn,
said the voice.
You're in a hospital. Is Gary with you?
Yes, Dina snapped. You hurt him.
Are they examining you?
No.
Just him?
Yes, Dina said, puzzled.
Right,
said the voice, and it sighed.
Vite, son cœur, c'est arrêté!
Called Gary's examining nurse, and all hell broke loose. Almost instantly, Gary was surrounded by medics, thumping his chest, blasting him with electricity.
What have you done?
Screamed Dina.
Bought time,
said the voice.
Easier to get him from the morgue. Go outside and wait.
Dina leaned over the rail, letting a cigarette fall into the night sky that enveloped the Eiffel Tower.
So, are you going to tell me what's going on? She asked.
The call on her mobile had come as she stood waiting outside the hospital. Susan had been brief. Their lives were all in danger, and she must meet her at the tower immediately. The man you spoke to, did you recognize his voice?
No, but what about the photograph of Gary? Is he okay?
The photograph you saw of Gary was a mistake. It was of a memory you aren't meant to have yet. I don't know whether he will be okay. It depends on what he wants.
What are you talking about, Susan?
Dina, the man you spoke to made us. He's our father.
Are you mad?
Look. Susan held out a camera. Dina looked at the screen. There was a picture of her, Susan, and Gary, all smiling. With them was a proud-looking silver-haired man.
What are you saying? I don't remember this,
said Dina. From the stairwell, a figure emerged. I do, Dina. It was the happiest day of my life. It was only when the elderly man moved that Dina recognized him. The awkward half-smile, the way he didn't know where to put his hands. The happiest day, he repeated, when they invented a camera that could bring memories back to life. So I could pop into a little computer and see you again. That's why I created you. All my fault.
putting another camera into the fantasy. Stories within stories. All the memories got jumbled up. The old man shrugged. They warn you in the instruction booklet. I saw your death, Dina breathed. Not mine, said Gary. We had an affair 30 years ago. In Paris, I finally broke it off. Told you I was going back to Susan. You didn't take it well. You killed yourself. The death I saw back in that first picture was yours. I'm sorry. And Dina knew he meant it. Gary snapped his fingers and both Susan and Paris disappeared. Got to reboot the camera, he said. Any final image you want to see before you go? Dina looked into the viewer, constructing a picture of her wedding to Gary. Confetti, smiles, true love. That's sweet, smiled Gary kindly, and snapped his fingers.
So that was Picture This, our chain gang story, written by BBC Seven listeners, with Robert Shearman supplying the first and the last episodes. And as I mentioned earlier, Robert is here in the studio with me now.
Hello.
Shall we start at the beginning then?
I think we might.
Where did the idea come from?
Well, this is going to sound very rude, but I was given a camera by my wife for my birthday, and I didn't really want one, and I was a bit resentful of having to show tremendous joy in this, I think, rather expensive little item. So I must say now I really do love the camera, Janie. It's a great camera, but at the time when it was time to write episode one, it was very much on the forefront of my mind, so I made it about that.
Okay, so you set the scene, and then the baton was taken up by Ian McKenzie. And he's thinking about this camera in a slightly different way. In fact, let's just hear what he had to say at the time.
The original story left us sitting with the images on screen and the shock horror, but how to develop that into something that could take a part three and part four, because part two would just be getting away from the starting line, was a bit of a challenge. So I fixed on the idea of a telescopic lens that somehow changed the degree to which it could see into the future. It could be that the camera was zooming into a future truth, or it could be that the camera was a mischievous kind of creature and it zoomed into a possible future. I thought about putting something in that would be conclusive, but that seemed to limit the story down and make it difficult for a part three to follow on easily. And I felt ambiguity was probably better at the early stage in the story, because it meant that anybody who was coming after me would have the possibility of doing a range of things, which I felt gave another writer a better prospect.
And I suppose that's the judgment here, isn't it? Unlike one of the games in I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, you don't want to tie the next person down to
this. I think that I have the easiest job of all. I think starting a story is very easy. You just come up with something and you let it dangle. And I think that ending the story is actually comparatively easy, as long as you're true to what's gone before. I think that what I've been so impressed by week, is seeing how people have been so able to take what was there and yet still leave it open-ended enough for other people to actually be excited to carry on.
Well, of course, it was at this very early point of the story that we had the greatest variety of ideas, as you might expect. Liv Black and Helen Haffigy both had Gary and Dina heading off to Paris toot sweet, but Dave Addison wrote about a tiny caged creature that was called Malcolm.
Really?
That Dina kept in a wardrobe.
Oh.
He was over 500 years old and could manipulate time. What do you make of that?
I'd have rather liked that. Although, again, if this is about episode two area, I think what's going on there is that you're very, very much dictating the way that the next 11 weeks will progress. But I think that's a very, very good idea. It is something where you sort of feel that it ought to grow into something which is very, very big and strange and weird, or indeed become something which is quite small and intimate. And I think that what was, I think, very impressive about the range of entries that I saw was that they actually managed to do both at once. It became this thing about real people, but with this strange, unnerving bit of oddness running through it, which I think was very, very good. I think A Creature in the Wardrobe there would have been great fun. I wish I'd thought of that for the ending, actually. That would explain the whole thing. Dear.
OK, let's move on to the middle of the story now, and episode 5. Now, this was the one that introduced Susan and the affair.
Mm.
But there's a real twist at the end of this one, with Gary not knowing about the affair. Now, here's the author of that episode, Dave Wilner.
If I'm honest, I didn't even know that that was the twist it was going to take at the end until I thought, ooh, that's an interesting twist, I might try that. And then just sort of went back through it and looked at what I'd written previously and amended it slightly, and I thought, yeah, that could work, actually. Obviously, I thought about where I would take it next, whether the hand that was pushing was actually trying not to push and trying to pull back, and Dina was trying to save Gary, or indeed whether, you know, the ring actually belonged to perhaps Susan. She was a stalker who had, you know, researched all sorts of things about Dina and found out about her and decided that she would get the ring and it was her hand that was pushing her over the side. I'm not sure, really. And, of course, the other option is that the whole affair that he didn't know about, because the insinuation, of course, is it was between two of the girls, is perhaps it was between them and the cameras predicted it, but it hasn't actually happened yet. I should be interested to find out where it goes next, if I'm honest.
We were really kept guessing about that affair until the very end, weren't we?
Yeah, I think introducing Susan was a terrific idea. I think that it really made it into a much more human story suddenly, and actually gave a real nice edge of danger. I think that the problem I'd set up, actually, in a way, which was making the source of jeopardy some sort of inanimate object, meant that inevitably that just means that it gets very, very conceptual. And I think that once you get another character in who can provide a little bit of mystery, then things really began to spark. So I was very, very pleased to see Susan pop up.
Rather than, what was it, Malcolm the 500-year-old?
Malcolm, well, I mean, but Malcolm could have had an affair with him as well. I mean, it might have been a little bit more 18-rated, possibly, but I would have been quite happy with that as well, I think. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to the conclusion of the story then. And we had a number of listeners trying their hand at this at the same time as yourself. John Ravlett, who wrote episode 11, pursued the implication that Dina, Susan and Gary were some kind of androids. Steph May had a similar thought. But then you decided not to go in that direction.
Well, I mean, I think it's a very, it's almost quite an apt thing. Because if you're going to have these characters for over 13 weeks being these sort of puppets of 12 different writers, they almost become like androids. And I think actually that was quite a fun little suggestion. But when at the very end of it, I was just aware I had to give some extra twist. Because I think otherwise people might have felt that in some ways it had climaxed too soon. And I think actually that is the hardest thing of all these things, is trying to make another new idea come across in only 200 words. So I really like the android idea. I just knew I couldn't quite rest on everyone else's laurels and say, yes, that's it. Because people would have probably thrown things at their BBC 7 box. But it's a very good idea.
OK. There's a lot more we could talk about, but we've run out of time. Thanks to everyone who wrote in with your wonderfully creative ideas. And thank you, Robert, for being with
us. It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Now, if we could just get this digital camera out. Somebody wants to take a snap of this.
Oh,
it's a new camera we've just got, actually.
I think you should just put
just
that
turn
down.
Up the post.
I'm going to walk away.
I don't seem to know where it came from.
All I can say, Jim, is don't do it. Robert Shearman was speaking to Jim Lee about Picture This, the story which Robert began and ended with the other episodes coming from BBC 7 listeners. Ian McKenzie, Rick Travell, Tom Johnston, Dave Wilner, Christopher Stanners, Phil Girdleston, Jennifer Moore, David Hutchison, Jane Clements, John Radlett and Phil Kurthausen. It was read by Rena Prasad and produced by Paul Arnold.